Welcome to the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN Community Radio, licensed in Bella Vista, California, and transmitting from Round Mountain. Here, we explore the lives of triumphant humans who endure life's persistent challenges. Our guests are driven by passion and inspiration and live with a compelling sense of purpose. Their persistence, perseverance are brought on by tragic episodes or by wonderfully cradled lives. But for whatever reasons, guests will openly share their innermost feelings and beliefs that fuel their works. With determination, courage, and insistence, our guests are driven to put more into life than they take out. Please listen to these inspirational, triumphant stories. And yes, I am Henry Cuenca. Today's guest, Emily, known to her fellow volunteers as the Energizer Bunny, and Tenacious, was born in Pleasant Hill, California, where she learned her trade of work from both of her parents. Their existence was lower middle class, living in a small two-bedroom apartment with her sister. Both parents struggled to do the best for their daughters, and when Emily saw her and many other families struggling to get by, always wondering why, and most importantly, what she could do about it. Emily remembers times that her mother took her to feed homeless men who lived behind dumpsters, and she remembers having an innate sense that this could be considered living in America. This background set the tone and direction for our guest life. Today, she runs an organization whose sole purpose is building a voice for these working poor families and the many who have fallen quietly through the economic cracks, and she does it for pay, you will find stunning and noteworthy. Please listen to this heartfelt story. Emily Cunnison, welcome to today's show.
Thank you.
Well, it's glad to be here. It's a pleasure to have you here. Emily, why don't we get started by you telling us about your organization and what you do?
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Henry, for having me. So I'm a full-time volunteer at Western Service Workers.
Mm-hmm.
And the organization has been there since 1977.
That's here in Redding, 1977.
Yes, in Shasta County. We have, we're a membership association of low-income workers and their families. And so we have people that do service work jobs, you know, cooking and cleaning, domestic workers, people that care for the elderly, blind, and disabled, people that work at temp jobs, landscaping, farm workers. A lot of the jobs that keep our economy running, and they're really critical work, you know, cleaning the hospitals, prepping food. But for most of those families, they're often working two or three jobs. And it's just because of the income.
That's an understanding. I mean, people know that, right?
Yeah, it's more and more people say, that's me. You know, I say, welcome to the majority. But, you know, kind of the working poor. But so we organize those families so they can build a self-help program and have an organization through which they can have a voice. Mm-hmm. You know, look at what is the root cause of my problem? How did this develop? What can I do to change it? How can I survive in the meantime? You know, because in many families, they're just trying to deal with day-to-day survival, let alone thinking, how do I get to the root of my problem, you know, when I'm working full-time?
Oh, I can understand that, clearly.
So, yeah, so what we do is it's volunteer-run 7 days a week. It's a community-supported program. We don't take any government funds, so it's just independent membership association. And
so all your funding is donations, right?
Right.
Entirely.
Yep. Mm-hmm. 7 days a week. We don't pay any staff. It's volunteer-run top to bottom.
So I guess, you know, I did mention at the beginning of the show that people would find your salary. You work 24/7 full-time?
Yeah, I'm a full-time organizer,
full-time.
Yes.
And you work about how many days a week?
7 days.
7 days a week. You actually do work 7 days a week?
Yes.
You're a college graduate?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep, from Sac State.
And you receive a stipend?
No. No income at all.
Do you have a private car?
We get donated vehicles. Everything is donated. The clothes I wear, the food we eat, you know, but it's all volunteer run. So all the volunteers put in the time to make it possible. And I've chosen for myself that this just makes sense, you know, and 11 years ago, I quit my full-time job to become a full-time volunteer. Uh-huh. And I wouldn't have it any other way. It just makes
well,
sense.
Well, that's stark. And I guess that's the rudiment of your organization, correct? Is that how they function in other areas?
Yeah, all of our – we have other organizations, sister efforts we call them, that organize the working poor and try to build a voice and operate through community support. And so all of them are volunteer-run. It's mm-hmm. the same method of building an independent voice for low-income families.
One final question along those lines. Do you have a 401k?
No.
No 401k either?
No.
Okay. Well, no. This is going to be very interesting.
Very along with most working people these days, that's part of why I'm here. Is it's not really just about me, but to the extent it is about my future, that I want a better future for my community, for myself, my family, and that's only going to happen, I see, through joining together, fighting to change the policies that keep people poor. And mm-hmm. most people, half of people over age 50, don't have any retirement in the country.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and that's a condition that I see we need to change, along with many other things. So that's why I'm here, mm-hmm. committed to that cause.
So you're here by spirit.
Mm-hmm. And my body's behind it.
Tell me more about your organization.
Right. So, we do two things, basically, because a lot of families, they're working, hard, like I said, and they're struggling with basic survival. So a part of our goal is to lift them, get their head above water, so they can even look at, wait, we have strength in numbers. We can join together to say, here's what the things are that we need to change. And so we have a benefit program that helps with immediate survival needs. So we have things like emergency food. We have doctors that volunteer their time and they see our members for free. So let's say they, because of their income, they make too much money to qualify for Medi-Cal. And if you're working full-time minimum wage, you are already overqualified.
Overqualified.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. So then that's out of your pocket and there's barely enough money every month to get by. So a lot of people go without medical care or they don't have dental care or eyeglasses. And so we organize volunteer physicians. We have four eye doctors in the community that donate exams and glasses for free every month. Mm-hmm. And so that's a way that our members can, get some level of survival ability, medical needs met. We also have a firewood benefit that during the winter can make sure that they have warmth. And it's all self-help. All the program is run by the people that need it. Mm-hmm. So it's members helping members. So it's very unique, and it builds into the second
really
part
is.
Of our program.
It really is. And the name of your organization, again, is?
WSWA for short, but it's Western Service Workers Association because of the service work jobs.
I would think, Emily, that most people in our community probably have not heard of your organization. Is that a correct assumption? It's not like United Fund or United Way or these other higher profile organizations.
Mm-hmm. I find for most people when we talk to them, we've been here for 41 years, so we have a huge base of support in the community because most people see, well, this just makes sense, to have a way we can survive, but really get to the root of these problems mm-hmm. instead of just being a Band-Aid to it. But you might have met us at your church or, a grocery store, and unless we've met people, they may not be familiar with us because we don't fit in the box of a food bank. It's a self-help association, not a charity. We're not a government agency. We're not a union, but we are trying to make sure people can fight to better their conditions. So it's mm-hmm. just a very unique program, and people go, oh, well, that makes sense, just sure. to do it this way. And then they find out, oh, my doctor's been volunteering for 10 years. Or, it really depends on who you talk to in the community.
And you've been in charge of this organization for how long now?
A little less than 10 years. I came up in 2008, right when the economy collapsed, and was able to help out then and learned in 2010 how to be the operations manager. Mm-hmm. So I was just, we teach through on-the-job training, so I learned how to do, the advocacy and build a base of support and go out and pound the pavement to talk to people about what we're doing. And through that, you can learn how to be in charge. Anyone can learn.
How many members are in your organization?
We thousands. We have... we sign up hundreds of members every year, so we've got about 15,000 members mm-hmm. or more. And it's just a matter of, making sure that everyone can stay in touch and that we have meetings and they can have their voices heard and we canvas areas and then we re-canvas areas. Because mm-hmm. For low-income families, the first thing to go is their phone, so we might be out of touch and then we re-meet them, on a community neighborhood canvas 3 months later and they go, oh, yeah, that's right, and I want to come down for one of those meetings. It's a very hard grouping to organize. It's people that are working at Taco Bell and then home care and then they're unemployed or maybe, they move because their situation's unstable. And so it's not an easy grouping to organize, but it's the most important, really, because that's the growing workforce in the country is the working poor.
Mm-hmm. I presume that you have some fairly strong organizational skills to make this thing work.
Well, yeah, and yes, I've learned a lot through organizing. That's, you know, I didn't know anything about organizing the community before I started volunteering. Uh-huh. You know, I knew there was a problem, but I didn't know what I could do about it.
What are your major benefits that you offer your members? Mm-hmm. If you could identify the benefits that you extend to them and give us an overview of how they actually work.
Yeah. Well, the primary is organization. Literally, you know, just having organization through which they have a voice. We always say that's the biggest benefit that we offer, is that kind of collective force. But the material benefits are, like I mentioned before, we have emergency food, but we also do supplemental food. So we have fresh food from the farmer's market we distribute every Saturday mm-hmm. at a local church that donates space for us to do that at. We, during the holidays, we do holiday food baskets and, you know, Christmas toys and all that so that families can survive, because you have a lot of bigger expenses at times of the year, like back to school and holiday mm-hmm. time and winter. And that can lead families to losing their housing, you know, or getting their utilities shut off. Mm-hmm. And so we help to survive those times and by joining together. So the members sign up and we do a whole intake and benefit program to look at what their hardest hit areas are. Mm-hmm. And then we organize that resource through talking to churches and working with groups, Kiwanis clubs, grocery stores. But we also have attorneys that volunteer. And so a lot of people have legal issues. So we have legal advice sessions and know your law sessions on labor law or landlord tenant. Just different things that people need to have questions answered and know how to navigate. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the doctors and firewood and
firewood,
clothing, many, many things.
You provide firewood in the wintertime, I guess, is what you're saying.
Yeah. And so the way it works is we build our membership through canvassing door to door in low income neighborhoods to reach mm-hmm. people. From there, we, you know, have membership meetings and we take benefit requests and we find out from the people most affected by the problem, what do you need? You know, what are the obstacles to being able to change these conditions? What are the things we share in common? And then we find, okay, people don't have, you know, medical care, or that maybe they don't qualify for a certain portion of their medical plan, like for optical. You know, maybe they have medical, but they don't have optical. And, you know, often those are considered separate, which of course a body cannot be separated like that. But mm-hmm. Insurance programs don't see it like that. And so we document the needs and then we find out, okay, what resources are available in the community to meet that need. So mm-hmm. sometimes we can say, you know what, you haven't signed up for Medi-Cal yet. Let's help you to do that. Mm-hmm. Or you know what, you don't qualify. So let's go ahead and find a doctor that can see you and maybe mm-hmm. get eye surgery, whatever it is.
So it's sort of a holistic approach then.
Yeah, I mean, comprehensive we would call it.
Yeah, comprehensive mm-hmm. entirely. So who else in the organization, who else in this area provides those types of services?
Well, we have a whole list of attorneys. Mark Fay is a labor law attorney that volunteers. We have Michael Kogan.
I meant other. What other organizations?
Do things that uh-huh, we do?
Right.
Other organizations, you know, of course, there's food banks in town and things uh-huh. like that. What makes us different is the membership aspect of it, you know, right. that we're involving a constituency of people that have common problems mm-hmm. and then we can work toward common solutions through that. And our members have a voice in the meetings. There's weekly meetings we do. It's mm-hmm. called the Workers Benefit Council, and they get to talk about, okay, here's what benefits are needed and here's what, you know, issues that I'm facing. We say, you know what, there's something we can do about that, mm-hmm. you know, give people hope through that. Mm-hmm. So it's very unique.
Obviously unique. How many volunteers, I should say, I was going to say employees, but we have none.
Right.
How many volunteers does it take to staff your organization?
Dozens more than we currently have. You know, we've got more and more needs that are coming in, especially with the fire. We've been dealing with uh-huh. hundreds of families that are affected. And so
answer that first. How many volunteers does it take to run the organization mm-hmm. in its day-to-day duties? Mm-hmm. And then tell us about the fallout from the fire.
Yeah. Well, we have probably a dozen volunteers a day that come in and help run the effort, give or take. You know, on some days we're having a food distribution for the holidays, and then we need 50 volunteers. Mm-hmm. You know, so it goes up and down, but we urgently need more people.
Always, I guess, huh?
But yeah, and going back to, so the fire, the car fire.
You know, we're going to have to take a break right now.
Okay.
So we're going to talk about the fire as soon as we return. Listeners, hang on. This is going to be a short break. If you're just tuning in, this is the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN 88.5, listener-supported radio. And I am Henry Cuenca, and my guest today is Emily Kinnison. So, Emily, before the break, we're going to talk about the fallout from the horrible fire season that we had here in Shasta mm-hmm. County. It was terrible, one of the worst, I think, that we've ever had. But tell us about your works through the victims of this disastrous fire that we had.
Yeah, we've been busy since day one of the fire. I mean, we've been we do what we call phone trees, calling everyone to make sure that they could evacuate and knowing where the evacuation centers were. And we provided a lot of transportation for people in and out and back from the evacuation center home. And we were also providing food, water, clothing. We obviously first start with our members. You know, we call and find out how are they doing and what are the needs and start responding to that. But then people flood in. You know, they call in, I don't know where to go and I need help and I need hygiene supplies. And so our members decided, the Workers' Benefit Council basically said, you know what, we need to make a vote to extend our benefit program to anybody that has a need. You know, we're in a disastrous emergency, so we can fill these requests. And we were consistently doing that from the beginning of the fire. And so we were finding people that didn't have transportation, they didn't have enough clothing, they needed food and water. A lot of people had taken in evacuees into their home and then had, you know, a greater burden on the household for food, and so they were coming in for food. So it's not just at the evacuation centers that there's a need, but there's, you know, the whole, you know, 40,000 people evacuated. Mm-hmm. So you had all these people that had gas costs and all these things that even just months after the fire, people are still reeling economically from it. Mm-hmm. And so during that, we would, providing immediate needs, but also looking at the advocacy. So people were coming in saying, you know, I need help getting my, you know, my wheelchair got burned up in the fire and Medi-Cal's not approving.
Who would ever think of something like that?
Right. Right. And so we can do the advocacy and break through bureaucratic hurdles. And in the meantime, you know, provide that need, you know, because mm-hmm. we were getting 300 different donations coming from literally throughout the state. We had people from Oregon, from Nevada, you know, so beyond the state, but people from Oroville down south were just flooding in trying to help and, you know, volunteer and see what they can mm-hmm. do and bring
so
clothing.
So they found the way to your doorstep then?
Yep.
Tremendous.
Yep. We were one of the only people that was accepting, you know, used and like uh-huh. new clothing and such, which uh-huh. was beautiful things that people were uh-huh. bringing, but uh-huh. we just figured out where we're going to distribute it and store uh-huh. it and you know, we're sure. still continuing to distribute that weekly.
Right. Is there any qualification that one needs to qualify to receive services through your organization?
There's participation is the number one thing that we ask members to do. You know, it's uh-huh. a members helping members program. It's as strong as members make it. But it's not required because, of course, if someone, you know, let's say they hear about our program, they need glasses. It's a single mom with two kids and she's working two jobs. You know, she may not have time that week or she may not guarantee, oh, next month I can contribute this many hours to volunteer. But she might say, you know what, I'd really like to be a part of this program and I also need glasses. Can I make a request? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. No one's going to be turned away.
Well, I guess that was my point that I was going to ask is mm-hmm. that this is open to anybody.
Yeah. It's based on need.
Yep. Let me throw you for instance. I'm unemployed, I'm disabled, I haven't received disability, I'm behind in my rent, I have a abscess tooth, mm-hmm. horrendous pain, I've got no dental insurance, I don't know any dentists, I don't know what to do. Can I come to you?
Yeah, I mean... We absolutely if people have needs like that, they should be signed up as members. You know, obviously they are low income and in need of organization. Uh-huh. Through our benefit program, we may or may not be able to address that immediate need, but absolutely we could advocate for them. We can make sure they get into the clinic. You know, for example, in the situation you're talking about, there's a local clinic that's supposed to be able to help with those emergencies. But right now they've got months and months long wait. But through the advocacy, we can have a person go down with them mm-hmm. and say, listen, this person needs to get in and try to waive the costs and get them in sooner. But we also have dentists that volunteer. So mm-hmm. on a case-by-case basis. And mm-hmm. so either one of those two, we can generally meet that need. Mm-hmm. But what we try to do is make sure people get what they have a right to. So why don't they have medical coverage? You know, how can we make sure that the clinic can see them and not have to wait 4 months? You know, there's a lot of obstacles to being able to get care. And we try to overcome
Certainly.
Those things through Right. organization and Mm-hmm. not, you know, just provide something when it otherwise could be provided through the county or the state or the Mm-hmm. responsible aid agencies.
You have mentioned the word advocacy three Yes. or four times. Why don't you explain to us what that really means?
Okay. Well, that partly goes back to the second part of what we do in our program, which is building that voice for low-income families, addressing the policies that keep people poor. And so the advocacy is, let's say someone's denied medical insurance and they, you know, they really should qualify and there's just some, you know, obstacle, like they can't prove some source of income and they mm-hmm. need help, you know, overcoming that. Or maybe that's going to take 3 months to prove, but they need medical care now. Mm-hmm. You know, the state is mandated to make sure that people have some level of medical coverage so they don't perish, mm-hmm. you know, and we see people that get far too close to that, you know, perishing, just being, you know, facing these obstacles. And so we get on the phone with whether it's Medi-Cal or the county or the state, and we'll make sure that we can overcome that, you know, and it's just the strength of organization on their behalf. And so what we try to do through organization is look at how do we make sure that the policies reflect the needs of the majority of working people.
So it's a broader perspective than when you talk about advocacy.
Yes.
It's just a broader, deeper long-term perspective of how are we not only going to solve this individual's tooth problem.
Exactly.
But others in line.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Those needs can come up at our membership body and we go, whoa, this is an issue affecting thousands of people. Let's go ahead and address it at the root cause.
I see.
So it makes sense kind of organically.
So, you know, your food bank, where do you get your food?
Through food drives in the community, grocery stores, you know, doing tables and food drives uh-huh. in front of the grocery store, uh-huh. Churches that collect. We have a huge need for collections of food, especially as we enter in the winter now and the holidays, is we're trying to have a mountain of canned goods because so many people, we're open every day. And so from 9 to 9, people can come in for emergency food. Very few places that have food are open that often. But also as a membership association, those members are involved and we can, you know, work with them on rectifying other problems that they have. You know, why are they out of food? Mm-hmm. Often there's another cause, and we can look at that too.
You know, I just recently heard or saw, I'm not sure which, or maybe it was both, that about 40% of all food ends up in the garbage, world production, mm-hmm. which just blew me away. And that grains, 60%, it leaves a big carbon imprint. But it ends up as a garnish on a plate and into the garbage. Mm-hmm. So it just blew me away to think that 40% of all food production in the world ends up in a garbage disposal or in the trash.
And yet we have huge rates of poverty and famine.
Well, you wonder,
you know, in this
they've got the wrong chutes going to the wrong places, I think.
Well, and it's a big contradiction. In California, we are statistically the wealthiest state in the nation, and I think the fifth or sixth largest economy in the world.
Exactly.
And yet we have the highest poverty rate in the nation. We have 1 in 5 people in poverty because mm-hmm. the cost for everything is so high. So, you know, if businesses can't sell it, it will be dumped because people can't afford it. You mm-hmm. know, so it's really an economic problem. You know, a lot of people, they work,
so how do,
but they
how
can't
do you solve
it.
That in the long term?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you solve those things in the long term?
Well, there's absolutely a solution. If you have enough resources, then your problem is really how are the resources going to get to where they're needed. And we see basically two things. One is that a lot of these problems that we have in the country, in the community, whether it's poverty or violence or, you know, lack of living wage jobs and lack of a tax base, they're all tied together. And a lot of the policies don't look at that comprehensively. They don't look at real, how do we get to the root of these problems? And so the other thing they don't do is really look at what are the conditions for the working poor, what are the conditions for the families, and how are those needs going to be met? You know, our members don't have lobbyists that can go to the Capitol
well,
and say,
I guess you are.
You know what?
I guess you
well, exactly.
Are. Yeah, that's what you do.
Yeah, that is what the organization does, and that's what the Workers' Benefit Council, that weekly, you know, membership body is about, is the voice of the working families that are struggling and people on fixed incomes that have worked hard their whole lives mm-hmm. and now seeing, you know, their benefits whittle away. What do we do about that? So last year we were combating a budget cut to in-home care, which is a program that cares for elderly and disabled. And that's something that never makes sense to cut, you know, but that's something that we were able to make a drastic difference in. We got a cut of $600 million reduced to $400 million mm-hmm. or actually $200 million. So we reduced it by $400 million by, you know, organizing a letter writing campaign, going to the Capitol, addressing these needs and saying, hey, the care for elderly, blind, and disabled actually saves taxpayers money because you're keeping people out of institutions. If you can care for them at home, then that's a better use of tax funds. So we have to often make sure that we let the policymakers know, here's what the needs are for the majority and here's what makes sense in the long run, versus in the short term, they think, well, we're just going to cut these programs and it makes sense. And the resources are not getting to where they're needed.
Have you ever been called a social activist? I mean, isn't that kind of what you are?
The program trains people on how to do that. I mean, it's
But you yourself personally, I mean, aren't you? Mm-hmm. I mean, would you take that as a compliment?
Yeah,
if I said
absolutely.
Right.
Thank you. It's a community labor organizer.
I think you are. Obviously, you're very intelligent. You know what's going on.
Well, I've been affected by the problems, too. I mean, both my parents worked full-time and struggled, and I see tons of families are going through this. So I think what I've been given by, you know, working in the organization is the methodology and the tools to join the community together along, you know, common lines and not be divided. You know, there's business owners that are struggling just as much as our members.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, we unite them together and we say, hey, all of us are, you know, from the bottom up, we need to join together. And that's what's effective.
You know, I know nothing about or very little about your background, but your work is very far-reaching, and you're driven by something. And has anybody ever tagged the name on you as a potential saint? My goodness sakes!
I don't think I could take that. That's a lot of responsibility, but it's just, you know, it's materially needed that we have people that can learn organizing skills to do these things in the community, mm-hmm. that can devote themselves to that. Mm-hmm. You know, I think most people are as concerned as I am.
How did you learn your organizational skills?
I really would say just when I started volunteering, I didn't know, you know, what was possible. I mean, I started coming in and I had the concerns and the urgency and the need to address these problems, but I didn't know darn thing that could be done about it. Mm-hmm. And so I would, you know, we go canvassing and I learned, oh, here's how you can unite low-income workers together and
overcome
divides. You ever get
a door slammed in your face?
Very rarely, actually.
Really?
Very rarely. Because, mm-hmm. you know, what we lead with is, hi, we're the ones, you know, fighting to change conditions for working families and mm-hmm. trying to stop utility rate increases. They're like, come on in, you know, please. You know, you want to look at my utility bill right now? You know,
it takes a lot of courage to walk up and knock on doors.
Mm-hmm. It's the courage of knowing that someone's got to do it, you know, and it's also knowing that this program is something that people have only something to gain from, uh-huh. you know, and that if what happens if we don't join together, you know, we're all just struggling individually and going to keep going down.
So what is this within you that makes all this work? There's an enormous amount of passion that goes into this. We haven't talked about that, but something is fueling your works. What is it?
Well, I would have to say it's just the understanding that it just makes sense, you know, for me that in the long run, we've got to look at what are the things that are going to change, you know, these conditions in our country and within our local communities. And seeing our, you know, we have a strategy, which is organizing low-income workers together from the bottom, uniting allies from the diverse strata in the community. And when I see that in practice, you know, like when I first started volunteering, I was working with, I was going to the farmer's market and picking up produce. And I was, you know, that was after canvassing neighborhoods and knowing what the needs are in the community, mm-hmm. you know, for low-income families. And then, you know, going out and talking to farmers. And at that point, we were working on a campaign trying to stop a utility rate increase. And so there was an issue about utilities going up. And so we were reaching out to farmers and seeing, how are you impacted? You know, what do you think about this? And I got a earful. It was like, they were, oh, yeah, my rates are already too high. I'm barely able to, you know, pay the water bill. And, you know, and here's these guys that are business owners relating on the same level as the low-income families, and maybe just from a different angle. You know, maybe they're not getting utilities shut off, but they're struggling to be able to pay for medical care and water and utilities at the same time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here are these companies are raising rates and making millions or hundreds of millions, sometimes $1 billion in profit in the case of PG&E, while then raising rates on people when they're getting shut off. Mm-hmm. You know, and in the state of California, we shut off 700,000 households every year.
Do we really?
Yeah, that's households. Yeah. That's 2 million people a year.
Emily, we're going to need to take a quick break here. And so, listeners, we're going to be right back. Thank you. You are listening to the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN Community Radio, 88.5. And I'm Henry Cuenca, and I'm speaking with a very passionate, inspiring young lady, Emily Kinnison. Emily, before our break, I forgot exactly what I was going to ask you, but I guess we were talking about passion. And, you know, in this show, what I do with my guests is I try to connect all the dots of their lives to determine why it is that they do the things that they do. Obviously, you have many skills that are pretty obvious to me, but let's take a step back to when you were born. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about when you were born, where?
I grew up in the Bay Area in Pleasant Hill, which is by Concord.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and your parents were working class?
Mm-hmm.
Middle poverty level?
Yeah, my mom worked for California Children's Services, which just helps families that have children that are very medically disabled and, uh-huh. and such, and so they have a lot of medical costs, and so she worked there, and then my father worked for Safeway.
Uh-huh. So you were exposed to the giving environment really from your young age.
Yeah, I would say, I wound up, I was observant as a kid, so I saw things. I saw my parents working and still struggling, and they would talk about the bills, and, that's just, I think, a common thing for most kids in this country these days. Mm-hmm. And then I would, see other families that are going through the same thing, and my mom would still take us and try to help as much as she could. She had very little time. She would get off at 7, and I would see her after that. And
7 at night?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so she, working more hours than she got paid for sure. But and still we struggled. But then she would take us and try to do as much as she could within that time. And so I got to see, different levels of poverty. People that were, like you said earlier, living behind a dumpster. And I just thought, how is that living?
This doesn't make sense. Tell us about that experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a gentleman that, I don't know his name, but he lived behind a dumpster regularly. And so my mom, I don't know how she found him, but knew where to always find him, basically. And we would occasionally go and, feed him a sandwich or give, and she would kind of call out his name so he would come back and be able to take the food. And he always wore his wearing the same clothing. And eventually at one point we just realized he passed away because he wasn't there anymore. Mm-hmm. And so that stuck with me in knowing that we have people that live behind dumpsters in this country.
Do.
And that they shouldn't.
There's probably more and more that are sleeping behind dumpsters.
More and more. Especially after 2008, we have people that, they say the economy is recovered, but we have many more people that are working temp jobs, mm-hmm. part-time, living out of their cars, teachers living out of their vehicles, mm-hmm. Things that shouldn't be happening. So that's why I'm doing what I'm doing, is to turn that around.
So tell us more about your growing up years. You live in a small apartment, your mm-hmm. parents and your sister. Tell us about your child life, things that you remember.
Well, it was pleasant. we did the normal things that kids do. It was in sports, and, my parents worked very hard to try to make sure that we could do that.
Do you have a bicycle?
Of course, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I was outdoorsy, and so we would always go around and play outdoors. And I know it's harder for parents to think about having their kids do that as much, but we were out all day, mm-hmm. and then come back at night. So, I was always very active. I was always very interested in reading and studying and, mm-hmm. Things like that.
Did your parents
wanted to do good in school for my parents,
Oh, so your
like
parents
that.
Did encourage schooling.
Yeah.
Were they graduates? Did they graduate from school?
My mom didn't. Both of them went to San Jose State, mm-hmm. but only my father graduated.
Mm-hmm. So they set a seed a seed in your mind of going to school.
Yeah, well, I would... like watching the news and always finding out about the world and learning was something that I was consistently doing. My mom and I would watch 60 Minutes every Sunday.
And about how old were you when you were watching 60 Minutes?
Oh, middle school.
So you were 9, 10 years old?
Mm-hmm.
So you were thinking on a different level at that early age.
Yeah, I think and I also just had a feeling of being an insecure kid, looking at, why is it that we're, my parents work and we still don't have the things that
And you were really critically thinking about those things at that young age.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I got in high school I started actually being really concerned and thinking about it as something that mm-hmm. my life should be, mm-hmm. Addressing.
What influences can you recall that were major during your life that led you to what you're doing now, mm-hmm. if you had any? People that you met or experiences or things that you saw, heard?
Yeah, well, my in high school, one of my professors, would talk a lot about what's happening with poverty and that we have plenty of resources in the country, but, yet and still we have people struggling. And I remember he brought in a group of veterans that came and talked to to students, and I got to talk to them and see how they were struggling and just what their thoughts were.
It was veterans
from wars.
Uh-huh.
From the Vietnam War, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that got me thinking, you know, seeing them in wheelchairs and hearing some of their stories. You know, it's hard as a veteran to survive. There's a lot of homeless veterans that our program deals with. So I was kind of starting to get a peek at that. And then when I was younger, both of my grandparents, you know, were ill, and my grandma had had a stroke and my other grandma had dementia. And so I would go and visit them in care homes. And, I just got to see how a lot of people live, you know, I wouldn't consider it living. You know, they're almost warehoused, not by their families necessarily, but because there's not a lot of support for elderly care, and there's not a lot of support for caregivers. And so they, you know, it was a very depressing situation to go and visit people in those convalescent hospitals. And so I start to think, well, what about all these people? You know, what do we do with our elderly? You know, and just kind of seeing them almost thrown away. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, seeing at the same time the importance of the caregivers, you know, and that kind of level of caring for people and how dirty and yucky it gets, and, you know, dealing with people that, you know, might be angry and you have to care for their needs, mm-hmm. you know, and then realizing those people are low paid, and it just didn't make sense to me.
So you had a sister, and your sister was older or younger than you?
Older, 4.5 years old.
4.5 years. So I'm interested to know whether she started to view the things similarly like yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Did she?
Well, she became a teacher. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, very much. And she wound up working in low-income schools in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. And so she's actually the person that brought me in, because they met.
Oh, so she was a footstep ahead of you.
Yes. Yeah, uh-huh. She started volunteering before me officially, so she's got me for that. But
so this whole philosophy was systemic. From sound like from your mother.
Mm-hmm. I think we had our eyes opened. I think that, you know, a lot of people have their eyes open. I just feel lucky to know what I can do about it. And I think that's, you know, what really, when I started volunteering with Western Service Workers, and I thought, ah, they're okay. Now I can do something about these problems. I think a lot of people have their eyes open, and I know I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, what can be done?
Do you collaborate with your sister?
Well, she works still in the education field, so I talk to her constantly about, you know, the struggles for teachers and, you know, how they're buying their own materials in school, mm-hmm. and, you know, because of the budget cuts and things like that. So, you know, part of why she wound up starting to volunteer was because she was seeing low-income children in her classroom and knew that there was something more, you know, that they were affected by.
Mm-hmm.
And she was interested in looking at how are the parents impacted, because, you know, they would talk about foreclosure. They would talk about things that really middle school, you know, students shouldn't know about. And so, you know, she came in and then she brought me in, and I started looking at, you know, what can be done about the problems. And mm-hmm. I had an orientation with my first experience was picking up baked goods for the organization and helping with the distribution. And I got to talk to a domestic worker there who was a caregiver for her.
And this was where and when?
Well, this is Sacramento in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
So this is about 11 years ago when I started volunteering. And, you know, there was just a lady there that was actually an organizer, but she was organizing whenever she could, but she was otherwise a caregiver for her blind husband. And she was, you know, telling me about the program and reading from a little format, you know, that would help explain, you know, what volunteers are needed for and how it works and who the members are and things like that. What is poverty? And so as she was reading it, I was helping her to read some of the words, because she had a little difficult time with pronunciation. I knew she knew what she was talking about, but, you know, some of the words, because she hadn't been afforded the opportunity like me to go to college, and even that was a struggle for me, you know, but I had a better vocabulary than her. And so as we're going through that, though, I'm realizing at the end of the orientation that I learned more from her about what I could do, you know, about these problems than I had in 4 years of college.
Well, that's a pretty mm-hmm. big statement.
Yeah, which makes sense, because the people that are affected by the problems and, you know, the real world experience goes so much further uh-huh. towards solutions than, you know, than just some academic pursuit.
Talk to me about inequality.
Well, so much comes down to that right now. You
well,
know?
I mean, talk about it. I'd like to hear what you have to say about that. Our listeners would.
Well, I mean, the largest, you know, inequality really is obviously the fact that we have so many people living in poverty. Half the country is low income or impoverished. And that's according to the federal government. That's not, you know, and so it's probably even more than that of people that are struggling. And at the same time, we have huge amounts of resources. The state of California agriculturally could feed the whole nation. There's no shortage of food.
Is that a fact?
Oh, absolutely.
California mm-hmm. could feed the whole nation?
Mm-hmm. Yep, with our Central Valley and Mediterranean climate. You know, and you know, there's a lot of things that need to be dealt with on that end in terms of environmentally and with climate change.
So in other words,
fires.
In other words, with all the production of other foods mm-hmm. in the other states could be thrown down a dumpster, and that's the 40% of all the food that's thrown away.
Yeah, and a lot of it's exported where they can make more money selling it. You know, so it's you know, if we wanted to, we could feed the whole country, you know, for mm-hmm. relatively affordable. Mm-hmm. You know, but at this point, people are going without food because they can't, or they're going without healthy food, that's for sure, mm-hmm. let alone going without food mm-hmm. because they can't afford it. You know, and so inequality in nutrition, you know, and if people don't have good nutrition when they're kids, then they can't, you know, literally their brains don't develop as well. So if we want a healthy future, we need to invest in, you know, early childhood education and health and nutrition programs, making sure that families have living wage jobs. But we are getting further and further away from that every year. You know, they're cutting aid to schools and children and not for lack of resources. You know, California has tremendous resources, but $48 billion of it goes into huge tax breaks for mostly corporations that have large lobbyists. So we have to kind of be a counterweight to that and look at prioritizing the long-term needs of our community.
You remind me of Dorothy Day. I'm not sure whether our listeners may know about Dorothy Day, but she was an American journalist, social activist, that became quite a profound movement, started a profound movement in the United States for the working folks. And you're mm-hmm. nodding your head, so you know a little bit about her. Do you ever see yourself as part of her?
Well, I know I've read her publications. You know, people have mentioned that because that's, you know, she was connecting the dots with, you know, faith and, mm-hmm. you know, what Jesus did and mm-hmm. all those things. And then that you can't talk about those things without talking about social justice. Mm-hmm. You know, and eliminating the conditions that are causing it. Mm-hmm. So, which is, I know it's consistent with a lot of what, you know, the Pope's talking about right now, but it's mm-hmm. kind of reliving a lot of what she was mm-hmm. bringing up, which was valid, you know, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Absolutely. You went to school. You went to college. Where'd you go?
I went to Sacramento State University, California State University, Sacramento.
And you graduated
mm-hmm.
with a degree?
Yeah, I studied communications. No, I had no idea what I would go into. I thought I might be a social worker, a teacher, educator. I wasn't sure, so I wanted to keep it broad so I could figure out, you know, what I could do to, you know,
make the world better.
Yeah, and really figure out what needed to be addressed and try to take a comprehensive approach to it mm-hmm. and not just be a Band-Aid to it. But mm-hmm. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And by the end, I was working for a child care advocacy organization at the end of college. And then I worked for a wildlife conservation organization and just, you know, to be able to pay back my student loan debt. But in the process of that, I started looking at, you know, all of these kind of as symptoms of a greater problem. And so I wanted to look at what can I do to deal with what I found to be, mm-hmm. organizing the disenfranchised communities that can address all of these issues. Because it all comes down to people.
You had mentioned during one of our breaks that you saw a division in high school by the cool kids and the regular kids. Could you tell us more about that? Because that's a very young age to make these distinctions. Mm-hmm. So tell us about that.
Right. Well, I had friends in a lot of different variety of places, and I was in the leadership club, and then I was also, you know, in sports, and you know, so I got to see kind of the whole spectrum, and it just...
Were you a cheerleader, too?
No.
Okay.
So I got to see the different, you know, groupings, and really what I saw by having friends in a multitude of groupings was, you know, we're all the same, and people all want the same things, and everyone's insecure, and everyone's struggling in different ways. And I really saw it was just artificial divisions mm-hmm. that are more have to do with, you know, what we're taught from the age that we're young, that, you know, that we, you know, have to think of ourselves as either different or better. And I just really saw that was just divisive. And I see that, you know, right now with, you know, people being divided politically. It's just they need to, I look at them, what the organization looks at is building unity, looking at what do we have in common mm-hmm. and materially, not just, you know, something that feels good, but hey, we all need to survive. We all need jobs that pay enough to live on. We all need utilities. We may not all agree on the other side issues, but by working together, we realize, you know, that's our strength, you know, and if we can meet our basic needs, then we can thrive from there. you know, and that's a lot more unifying. And that's material, though. We have to get people together face-to-face to establish that, and that's what we do.
So there's so much to talk about with you, Emily, really. So you graduated from Sac State with a communications degree. Mm-hmm. Why communications?
Well, education. I thought, how do you get across information to people where you can make an impact, whether it's helping people understand.
So that was a calculated thought why you wanted to. It was. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to help people. I thought, you know, knowledge is definitely power, but then, you know, how do you? Well, at that point, I didn't know what else I could do besides just education. Mm-hmm. You know, now I've learned. Well, you have to also have, you know, material ability to advance, you know, with knowledge.
If someone walked into your office and said, here's $1 million, what would you do with it?
We would keep organizing the exact same way that we did before they did that. You know, obviously we would, right now we would do renovation for the office. We're trying to go solar. We're trying to, you know, upgrade the weatherization so we can keep our utility bill down. You know, those types of things. We would look into future program expansion. That'd be a lot of gas for a lot of caravans for the future. You know, we invested in something that can establish a permanent base for our members.
Would you?
You know, we need a benefit office. That would be fantastic.
Would you pay your volunteers?
No. Which they wouldn't expect, and you know, people wouldn't want. If we're here for the principle of really establishing something that can get to the root of these problems, we don't want to, you know, do something that's going to create an ulterior motivation.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Emily, we have to take another break. So listeners, we're going to be right back. If you're just tuning in, this is the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN 88.5 FM, community-supported radio. And I am Henry Cuenca with my guest today, Emily Kinnison. Emily, we're talking a little bit about your education. You went to Sac State, have a degree in communications to learn how to communicate better with people and to organize. Tell us where you see yourself. What is your vision for the future for what you do?
Well, I see, you know, we're going to keep growing because that's where the economy is headed. You have more people that are working in these unstable jobs and low income, and the working poor is just going to become the majority of jobs. And so the positive in that is that we've made major gains and major victories. So the more that we organize struggling families, the stronger that we get and the ability, you know, to have a voice and grow. So, for example, this year, we made huge gains with our local utility company, and that's because so many people struggle with the cost for utilities. And so
tell us about the gains that you made with them.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the problem is that they shut off about 3,000 households every year in the city of Reading, and that's because the cost for utilities have gone up.
That's $250 a month.
Yes, exactly. And so we deal with a lot of those families, which is how the campaign to fight to change that came about, as we were having so many people coming in with shutoffs and, you know, on breathing machines. We just had someone last month that was on a breathing machine that got shut off of their power within the city of Reading. And so there's no protections for that. There's nothing that would say, oh, no, you know, you're going to never going to be able to be shut off in that situation. And so we deal with a lot of advocacy, and then through that we were able to identify, okay, well, there's a problem of utility rates going up. There's a problem of late fees being charged. The city of Reading charges about $36 a month in late fees if you get both of the late fees. And that money gets collected to the city general fund. And so it's $2 million a year approximately that the poorest residents and people that are behind on the bills are paying in addition to their bill. And so those are big issues that most people in the community are concerned about. And so we've identified certain things that the city of Reading could do to change that. And so we've made tremendous progress. There's more to be done. But recently, we got the low-income discount expanded by $900,000. So they basically doubled the discount. We got a $2 million weatherization program established by having the city of Reading get a grant from the state of California for that so that people's bills can go down. Because often if you're in a two-bedroom apartment, it's low income, you might pay $200 or $300 a month in bills because of in utilities because of the weatherization. You know that you are leaking everywhere. So we also ended this year's rate increase though. That was a 1.5% rate increase that the city of Reading had planned, and so that was ended. And we ended the reconnect fee. So there's huge gains we've made through joining churches and assistance programs and low income families together to meet with the city and to go over these things and look at common concerns. And so, and one thing I wanted to mention is just in case anybody's listening, I wanted to give our address and phone number.
We do have listeners.
Of course you do. But in case anyone who's listening is interested in volunteering, we have an office that's...
And I'm sure there's going to be.
Mm-hmm, okay. I hope so because we urgently need people that can get involved. The phone number is 244-0968, and our office is right behind Big O Tires off of Cypress. It's 2350 Beverly Drive. And we're open there 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m.
And your phone number again?
244-0968.
And that's area code 530.
Correct.
If you're out of the area.
Yes.
So go ahead.
Okay. So that was a major victory this year is getting those policies to change so that less people would have their utilities shut off. But that took organization, and now we're at the point of trying to work with the city to deal with statewide policies, because it's statewide and really nationwide that utility rates are going way beyond what people can afford. And the state of California has 21% more electricity than we need, but the costs for it have gone up hugely. So we have to look at what's going on. How do we get it to where it's affordable and the cities, that are municipally owned can actually afford the cost of power? And so there's a lot to deal with on that.
Emily, do you consider yourself successful?
Yeah, I don't think the goal has been accomplished yet, but I think we're well on our way to get there, because you have to have a base of people in the community that are joining together, and that's what we've been building. And that's why we've had major victories is because we have, business owners and doctors working with low-income families, all looking at some of the common things that we need to change, whether it's coming, having money come in at the bottom or, affordable utilities or whatever it is, that you have to be able to join the community together and get the government to, recognize that certain things on a policy level need to change and we need structures that can facilitate that. So when people are working together, that's, the first step. We've been doing a lot.
But you know where the catalyst for all this is? You need somebody to make things happen.
Correct.
And
you need organizers.
And that's what you do. Mm-hmm. Precisely. I don't think that I've ever spoken with anybody that is so focused and so determined to drive what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Purely out of passion.
Well, and there's other organizers that we work with throughout the country. I mean, people that have committed their lives to this cause, and it's because there's a tried and true way of doing it, and there's a method, and it's teachable and trainable. And so that's one thing I like about the organization is anybody can learn. Anybody that cares and that wants to get to the root of these problems can learn how to do it, no matter what time they have.
Do you grow proteges?
Do we train? Yeah. Do we have proteges? Absolutely.
I mean, that pick up your passion and go off on their own?
Yes. Yeah, we do. There's people that learn full-time organizing, and then they apply those skills, elsewhere, and some people learn it, and they become an organizer, mm-hmm. and they help us start a new organizing drive, mm-hmm. where it's needed. There's many, many places it's needed. That's why our biggest need is for full-time volunteer organizers, mm-hmm. That can lead the effort.
Mm-hmm. I once read that if you can't figure out your purpose, figure out your passion, for your passion will lead you directly to your purpose. And I guess you're living your purpose.
Mm-hmm. I guess you would say that, yeah, I get to live the principles mm-hmm. that I see or, that I wish everyone could live by, mm-hmm. but it's a lot of work. It's not like it's easy
well,
for
yeah,
anybody.
But yeah, I mean, of course.
But I feel lucky to do it.
So what are your most gratifying moments?
Well, I mean, on a daily basis, we have gratifying moments. I mean, and we just right now we're working with a lot of the car fire victims. And so a lot of people have been denied FEMA aid and, you know, have legitimate claims that they need help with. And so we advocate, and sometimes we'll, you know, win cases, and it's, you know, taken weeks and weeks of work.
Now,
and so,
what do you mean win cases?
Well, for example, we have a gentleman that was, he lost his home in Keswick. He was only insured for $34,500 from his insurance company. And he lived there 37 years. He lost everything. And FEMA denied him because they said, well, you have insurance. Off the bat, you know, denied. And so we said, no, there's a way you can appeal it and you can explain your situation and how much it costs to actually rebuild and what you lost. And so we were able to document and help him do advocacy with FEMA, do an appeal letter. And we just won him $30,000 2 weeks ago. You know, so that's huge. And you only
That's tremendous. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Right. What other forms of gratification do you find?
I'm seeing the leadership that grows out of the community. You know, we canvass low-income neighborhoods every week. We hold our membership meetings, and we have members that run, you know, all those parts of the program, and people that are at the lowest, you know, they've gone through the ringer. You know, they just lost their job. One lady who's actually our membership coordinator, you know, lost her home to foreclosure after 11 years, and that was after having cancer and after her husband, who did construction work, lost his job, and it just kind of went downhill, and then he got dementia. And so Wells Fargo says, well, you know, we're foreclosing on you. And so she becomes homeless. And we were able to advocate.
Literally. I mean, she's out in the streets here. Huh?
Yeah, well, she's not anymore. I mean, we advocated for her and we got her into the county program and helped overcome a series of obstacles to finally get them housed.
How long did that take you?
Months. Yeah, 2 months.
Emily, it's been wonderful to have you on our show. If you want to give your number one more time, we're at the end of the show. Give us a number for anyone that would like to volunteer in your organization.
Yes, please call us. We urgently need volunteers. It's 244-0968. And we're also going to be collecting holiday food, and so we need 300 turkeys, things like that. People can bring in or come and volunteer and help us distribute them. 244-0968.
Emily, thank you very much for being my guest today. You have been listening to community-supported KKRN 88.5 FM. We are supported by listeners like you and brought to you by volunteers from the community. Are you ready to support your local community radio? To become a listener supporter, go to our website at kkrn.org and click on the donate button, or mail a check to Post Office Box 188, Montgomery Creek, California, 96065. You can call 530-337-1101 to volunteer at KKRN Community Radio or to learn more. Thank you for listening to the Henry Cuenca Radio Show, where we are in earnest working to make our community and our world a better place. Please tune into my show each first and third Tuesday of each month at 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Here you will listen to another triumphant human story. I would love to hear from you, so please send me an email at henry@kkrn.org. Again, that's henry@kkrn.org. Or call me directly at 530-356-9811. And thank you for listening.